Okie dokie, let's kick this off. Joining me today is the mighty Dan McMillan. Thank you for spending some time here with me this morning, Dan.
It's good to be with you, Jay.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind sharing your background with us and maybe a few words in German. I saw that you speak fluent in German. That's pretty cool. That'd be a big, tall glass of water if you could do that for us.
Also, ich soll etwas auf Deutsch sagen. Ja, das ist, ich könnte den ganzen Tag auf Deutsch reden, aber das wäre schon verwirrend für das Publikum. So, anyway,
perfect.
I could translate, but I think you'd rather I not. No, just kidding. But let me just, my first career, I was an academic historian. My field was modern Germany. I lived in Germany for 2 years of my life. Have a lot of friends there, speak the language. 10 years ago, I published my first book, and it's the only one of my books that's actually been published, called How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. And it is an essay on the causes of the Holocaust for the general public, written without academic jargon, and I think quite readable and also very brief. And it's because the causes of the Holocaust were many. It wasn't, which is actually good news, because it wasn't enough for one thing to go wrong, or two or three, for this to happen in our most advanced society. It took about a dozen things to go wrong, and they were all necessary. And so the picture is very complex, and you need an overview that pulls together all the main pieces of the puzzle in a fashion that's comprehensible and easy to digest. And I take a lot of pride in how easy the book is to read and how accessible. And I recommend it highly, needless to say, available on Amazon and Audible, Kindle, and hardcover. And then after I finished, I should also mention as part of my background, I taught college-level German and world history for 5 years, and four of them out in Illinois at one of the state university campuses at Eastern Illinois U.
Oh, nice.
Then I decided I wanted to try something different. I moved back to New York, got a law degree, worked as a prosecutor for a few years at the Brooklyn DA's office, and really did not like it. Quit in order to become a writer, published my book on the causes of the Holocaust, and then I decided that my next book was going to be about money in American politics, because I have long felt that the way that candidates pay for their hyper-expensive election campaigns, namely by taking massive donations, pardon me, from hyper-wealthy Americans, special interests, and corporations, that this effectively disenfranchises the rest of us, that really more and more that the donors are the true constituents of our so-called representatives in Washington, and we, the people, are out in the cold, that we, the voters, are effectively a necessary evil. They still need our votes to get into office, but the people who really count for them and the people they listen to and spend their time with are their donors. And I've long felt that this was the biggest single flaw in our political system. And I already, when the copy editing was done on the Holocaust manuscript in late 2013, I started research and writing on what was going to be my second book about how money was ruining government by the people here in the land of its birth, and what's the best way to fix it. And I researched all these different reform proposals. And by the spring of 2020, I had written several hundred pages in different sort of unpublished chapters, and decided at that point that publishing another book is not going to make any difference, because I'd read all kinds of really interesting books about this or that aspect of the money problem, and none of these books had moved the needle politically, not one iota, and another book by me was not going to make any difference either. And that's when I decided that I had to bite the bullet and figure out how to become a politician. And I founded my organization, Save Democracy in America, in the spring of 2020. And we have one goal, and that is to build support, and it's going to have to be massive support among Americans, left, right, and center. It's got to be bipartisan among the voters, for the voter dollars system for the public financing of federal elections. And that's luckily one of the political strengths of this concept is how easy it is to summarize, because basically, the problem we've got is that the only people with any clout in our political system are heavy campaign donors. So the solution is to make ourselves the donors. And the way this would work in practice is that for every two-year cycle, every registered voter would get an online account of campaign cash. You can't take it out and spend it, but you go online and you assign these voter dollars to the candidates that you want to support. And if we fund the system at the robust levels that we're demanding, candidates who want to serve the American people can raise enough money from us. And on the other hand, their opponents no longer have any excuse for taking money from billionaires and special interests. And in that way, we could then have government by the people. I mean, in effect, when they get to Washington, our elected representatives would keep on doing what they do so well right now, namely representing their donors. Only when we're the donors, then they represent us, and then we have government by the people again. Now, obviously, this is not going to solve all the problems in our political system. It's not a magic wand, but it's a great first step, above all, because in the last 4 years working on this and promoting it, I have found that this is a reform that absolutely commands cross-partisan support, no matter, and I've got all kinds of data to back that up, which we can get into if we want to, but no matter where we stand, you know, on abortion or gun control or taxes or any other issue, none of us in this country is okay with our government being for sale to campaign donors. This is America. So anyway, but I've been going on. Why don't I let you jump in, Jay, and see if you have any thoughts?
Boy, you have quite the background. I've been in sales for 15 years and speak English. Good Lord, man.
Well, listen, there's a lot to be said for sales. I really like salespeople. I tell you, I worked in book publishing for a couple of years, and the most fun I had during my brief time in the industry was the two sales meetings where I got to hang out with it was college textbook publishing, and they have these textbook salespeople who go to campus and visit with faculty and try to get them to adopt, you know, whatever major textbook that publisher is producing that year. I loved hanging out with them. You know, the salespeople they're people, you know, they're people. And I never worked in sales, but I always liked to feel that I could have succeeded at it. But of course, you really can't make that claim for yourself until you've actually done it and can cut the mustard. But
true. Hey, there's some sleazeball salesmen. Don't get me wrong, but that's
yeah.
there's
sleazeball politicians too, but I don't think I'm one of them.
Well said. Yeah. Also, talking about the special interest groups and the people that pay the politicians behind the closed door. You know, I feel like that the politicians should wear a patch, kind of like a NASCAR driver does, of who's sponsoring them, so we can all see it visually. Just, you know.
Oh, you rock, Jay. That is hysterical.
Wouldn't that be a wonderful idea? Just so you can see it. You're like, oh my God, he's bought and paid for, and there's just like a billion logos.
They would need an awful lot of patches, Jay. I mean, you wouldn't be able to see the white of the jacket. All you'd see is the patches. Because the thing is now, you know, ever since the Citizens United decision in 2010, which we can talk about, but basically what that decision, I mean, the money problem has been building since the 1980s, but Citizens United opened the floodgates in a couple of new ways. And it turned a disaster into a catastrophe. And since then, in the last 14 years, the cost of federal elections has skyrocketed. In practice, what this means, it used to be, as a representative in the House, that you could afford to maybe take your money from only two or three industry groups that were strong in your district. But now to run for national office, you got to take money from everyone, basically. So if you were going to put patches on your jacket like the NASCAR drivers, there wouldn't be room for enough patches. And that is one of the reasons, by the way, I think that it helps understand why our politics has gotten uglier and uglier across the last three or four cycles, is that because the folks in Washington owe favors to, in principle, everyone in Washington owes favors to to such a wide range of special interests, industry groups, and wealthy individuals, and so on, that you really all, pretty much every good idea for making a better life for our people is blocked. You know, you can't, we can't talk about how to bring down prescription drug prices, because then you don't get the money from big pharma and from the all these middlemen like the pharmaceutical benefit managers that you may have been hearing about. We can't stop health insurance companies from micromanaging doctors and driving good people out of the medical profession and finding excuses to deny coverage, so that 500,000 American families are driven into bankruptcy every year by medical costs, because that is in fact happening. We can't tackle that either, because if you even speak up about those problems and you're a candidate, then you lose the health insurance industry money. And it's that way all the way down the line. And more, you know, both parties in theory have a program for a stronger country, for a better life for Americans. But in practice, neither party has an achievable program. There's no positive way forward for us. And because of that, both parties have defaulted to overwhelmingly negative messaging, because anger is all they have left to offer us. And I think that's a very good explanation for why, you know, as really more and more, you know, partisan polarization has intensified with every cycle, sometimes by leaps and bounds. The anger has grown more and more intense. The rhetoric by politicians and people in the media has gotten crueler and more vicious and more violent. And it's no accident, it's no coincidence that the dramatically escalating partisan anger, the polarization, coincides pretty much exactly in time with the skyrocketing costs of federal election campaigns. That is, the coincidence in time is no coincidence. The money does a great deal to drive the anger. And there's a lot more that I can say about that, but that's probably one of the first things I want to say. And I think it's so important to say it, because the folks in Washington and the commentariat and in elite journals of opinion, they will tell us, gosh, why are the American people so angry and irrational? Well, this anger isn't coming from us, because, you know, by definition, Jay, 342 million people don't spontaneously become more angry, right? I mean, it's not like Vladimir Putin's agents put something in our water supply so that 10 years ago, you and I and everyone in our audience, we all woke up one morning and said to ourselves, gee, I feel unfulfilled, dissatisfied with my life because I don't have enough anger. I don't have enough hostility. And I get to get on the stick here and find somebody to hate, right? It doesn't happen that way. There are agents, there are political actors who stand outside the people and above the people to some degree, and they are polarizing us. And over time, they have succeeded. And they have succeeded in making a lot of us angry at each other, and they have succeeded. They keep encouraging Republicans and Democrats to fear each other, even to hate each other. And these polarizing actors are having some success at that.
Some of that has to come from foreign entities, wouldn't you say, with the use of social media now, with you can have some Russian troll farms on Twitter just planting themselves. Like, for example, if there's a Democratic group that like to talk to each other, like all of a sudden a Republican will get in there and start talking shit, but that's a Russian troll farm, just getting in there to make sure that division stays, you know, concrete.
If it were only the Russians, we could count ourselves lucky, but it's also the Chinese, it's right. The Iranians, yeah. Even the North Koreans, it's been going on. We've been able to document that as far back as 2016, and it's not even so much that it's to benefit one party over the other. It's to make Americans angry. It's to intensify the divisions in our society. And that's right. And the thing is, you know, in theory, I don't know exactly how you could regulate social media to make that harder to accomplish or to put a stop to it. But I'll tell you this, we have no chance of regulating these social media platforms in any way that might conceivably diminish their profits, because those big tech companies are massive donors to political parties. I mean, I think in 2020, the big tech Silicon Valley went very, very heavily for Biden, and I don't remember, unfortunately, off the top of my head, I don't remember how many tens of millions of dollars of help that he got from them. This cycle, it seems like a lot of that money is shifting to Trump, but no matter, either way, If anyone tries, even opens their mouth in Washington, even suggests, for example, getting rid of the Facebook algorithm. I mean, the Facebook algorithm polarizes people because the algorithm has learned that angry messages are clickbait. And the more clicks means more advertising revenue. And so the Facebook algorithm, and I think the algorithms on all these platforms, automatically feed people angry messages. And the algorithm figures out your pressure points, what makes you angry, and then feeds you more angry messages. And then when you've got these Russian or Chinese or Iranian bots, you know, increasing the amount of angry messaging, well, then you've got a perfect storm and a toxic message. I think there has to be a way that we can shut this down or limit it, but it almost certainly would cut into the advertising revenues of these big tech platforms. And they've got so much clout from campaign donations and the lobbyists they hire, that ain't happening either until we solve the money problem.
It's insane because you can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to kill yourself or kill somebody. You know, social media could be such a wonderful tool, but it's just the greed. It's just the greed. What gets the most clicks is anger. Yeah. So let's pump out the anger. It's so unfortunate that they've taken that route. You know, I look back to the days before social media and just kind of, I mean, there were still issues, but everything just seemed like more of a community where you're outside and you're experiencing real experiences and your face isn't just down in your phone and you're willing to go meet new people. Like if you go to a bar nowadays, like the dating scene, let me tell you, this is most people's, like, there's so many missed connections because you get a drink and you're drinking, and then you turn to your left to start naturally talking to someone. But as you turn to the left, their head is down on their phone, and then it's a missed connection, you know, and then it's vice versa. Like maybe they look at me and then my head's down on my phone. So I think we're missing a lot of that. And there's just, it's unfortunate. I hope we get back. I hope it's a pendulum and it's going to swing back one way. Maybe like I have a 7-year-old, so I'm hoping that they get teched out or something, just burnt out and they're over it and they want to go outside and live life like how we used to. I'm really hoping for that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that, like you were talking earlier about, you know, greed, like the greed of the companies that are happy to feed the anger to increase the number of clicks and therefore the advertising revenue. In a way, I don't fault the companies. I don't fault any of these economic actors, because the job of corporations and their executives is to maximize profits. I think the issue is that we, the people, have to set the guardrails and have to make sure that these practices or these companies don't end up doing things that are destructive. And if we really had government by the people, if we, the people, were in the saddle and calling the shots, we could do that. But right now, more than anything else, it's the money in politics that cuts us out of the equation, that leaves us out in the cold. The good news is, if I'm right about this, Jay, if I'm right that money is the number one problem, the central problem, if it does as much damage as I argue it does, we're in great luck, because there, you know, the money in politics is a problem for which there is a legislative solution or more than one solution. There are a lot of problems in every political system, including ours, that you can't legislate away. You can't legislate away people's prejudices. You can't make people like each other. And our prejudices do get in the way of making the system function well. But you can legislate away the money. And, you know, speaking, you talked about your 7-year-old. That was very, I don't have children, unfortunately, but my heart goes out to parents who see their kids staying indoors on screens, on social media, having social media quote-unquote friends instead of real flesh and blood friends, and staying inside when they should be outside, you know, playing baseball or even like when I was a bit of a delinquent, you know, breaking windows or something, you know. But I'd rather have my kid doing that than staying in the basement sucking up this mind poison from social media. And, you know, there are people out there who've said, well, we could have an enforceable minimum age of 18 for social media, just like we have a minimum age for tobacco and alcohol. And frankly, I think social media is a heck of a lot more dangerous than those two substances.
For sure.
But and make it enforceable. That is to say to these companies, you've got to just to let someone establish a Facebook account or a TikTok account, they've got to upload a birth certificate and a photo ID, and you've got to verify, and we're going to audit you periodically, and we find you're not doing your job, we're going to slap massive fines on you, and so on and so forth. But no one in Washington is even talking about legally enforcing an age limit for social media use, because if you do that, you lose all the big tech money. Not only that, but the big tech money is going to start flowing to your opponent and to super PACs that will run ads against you to crush you. So until we fix the money problem, Jay, we are spinning our wheels on every single thing we need to do to make a good life for our people.
Yeah, no, well said. I agree with you. I agree with you 100% on that social media thing with where there should be an age limit. Me and friends talk about that all the time. But when politicians start going against the grain, is that when we see assassination attempts?
You know, it's so hard to say, Jay. I mean, there's no question that Donald Trump goes against the grain and that people have very strong feelings about him one way or another. On the other hand, it's interesting, the president who had has had the most close calls was Gerald Ford, who was not polarizing and did not arouse, I think, strong emotions on anyone. And I don't know if you remember, but there were two attempts on his life that came very close. There was a woman named Squeaky Fromm, who had been a member of the Manson cult, but not prosecuted for the Tate LoBianco murders. And it was sometime like in 75, and she was able to walk right up to Gerry Ford and stick, I think it was an Army issue 45 caliber semi-automatic in his side and pull the trigger. It turned out that she didn't really know how to operate the gun. She hadn't chambered the first round.
Oh my
Otherwise,
God.
She'd probably be dead. Remember that?
No. Whoa.
Yeah. I'm remembering this right. I haven't looked at it. This is what I remember from like 40 years ago. My dad said, my God, he would have been dead before he hit the ground. You know,
for sure.
I mean, a 45 caliber, that's – my dad was in the Army. He talked about that weapon. He said, oh, my God. And then there was the woman named Sarah Jane Moore. She had a handgun, and she was able to – she got off several shots against Ford from, I don't know, only 20 or 30 feet away. And I remember an interview with her. She was just shaking her head in dismay. You know, she was so disappointed. My God, the man was right there in front of me. It was so easy to kill him, and I missed. You know, and it was so. And here's Gerry Ford, who was just a really nice guy, fundamentally a decent guy. I think a decent man. A lot of people were angry at him for pardoning Nixon, but it's so strange. So I don't know. A lot of it just depends on. It's very freakish. And all of the people who make these attempts are mentally ill. They're a wild card. So it's hard to say. It's not necessarily tied to the violence of the rhetoric. That said, the political rhetoric in American politics has grown more and more extreme and violent. And, you know, on both sides, you know, Trump says that Biden is going to impose a Marxist dictatorship. If the Democrats win, America is going to be lost. America will go down the tubes. And Biden, in turn, is effectively saying that Trump will impose a fascist dictatorship.
Right.
The world will also end that way, too.
Either way.
So that obviously doesn't help. But I guess for me, the main thing, though, specifically about the attempt in Pennsylvania is what the heck were the Secret Service thinking? I mean, I'm an amateur. I've never worked in security. I could have told them, just looking at the scene, you better get a counter sniper up on that roof, roof where that guy fired from. I mean, that was ridiculous.
That's why it's so
suspicious. Why that happened, I have no idea, but I mean, that's just bizarre.
Yeah, and to go back to that real quick, a 45 into your side, that will turn you into a bagel, a human bagel, for sure.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah.
Right through you. But yeah, there's so many things that stink about this assassination attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like why wasn't it cleared out? I mean, that building that the kid was on was like a football, how many yards away it was? Like 100 yards or so?
It
wasn't very
it
far.
It would have been, I think, no, they said 400 feet, so that's 130 yards.
Okay.
It's very close. It's very obvious. On the other hand, I find it impossible to imagine that anyone in the Secret Service would have deliberately been lax here to allow Trump to get assassinated. I mean, there are people who suggest that. I think there are people who've been arguing that. That I don't buy for 1 minute for all kinds of reasons. But something's wrong. And I do agree. I think that, I mean, I'm nonpartisan. And frankly, I don't like either party or either candidate in this race. As far as I'm concerned, both parties are failing the American people. The system is failing the American people. And for me, job one is transforming the system. And that's why all I really care about is money and politics. That said, when people call upon the head of the Secret Service to resign, I think she absolutely should. She should take responsibility for this. This is, I mean, look, it's, you know, the buck stops there. And this is a screw up of massive proportions, and heads do have to roll. So why anyone is hesitating on that score, I really do not understand.
Well, we know that Trump has said previously that he wants to get us out of Ukraine. He doesn't want to keep sending money there. He wants this war to end. And that's terrible for the industrial war complex, which makes my mind go to, well, that's a lot of money that Trump wants to stop putting out. So, I mean, he becomes a target in my mind. We know that the CIA, like, attempts to murder people. We know this. MGK, or what's it called? MK Ultra. That was a huge project that was just so dehumanizing. The JFK assassination attempt, they won't release the files. Even how long has it been?
If we start getting into the merits of those theories, we're never going to get to the end of it. I'll tell you this, Jay. I want to just give you my take on conspiracy theories like those, which is that I've never bought into any conspiracy theory, including about, you know, the murder of President Kennedy, because I think Benjamin Franklin had it right. He said, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead. And the problem with all conspiracy theories is that they require, for them to work, hundreds or even thousands of people have to keep their mouth shut. And that's not possible. That said, you know, I think it's interesting to ask. I guess, you know, I have friends. I have just going off on a tangent a bit, but I have a good friend of mine, a rock climbing buddy of mine. In fact, he and I climbed El Capitan together in 1991 in Yosemite Valley.
Oh, so you're a crazy person.
Exactly, like me, a crazy person. Yeah, no, I mean, this is a guy, a good man, a family man, with a physical therapist, with a graduate degree and a skilled occupation. A man I quite literally trusted him with my life, and I would do so again without a moment's hesitation. And he's very excited. He really follows Q. He's into QAnon, and we've had some conversations. And what I say to Joe is, look, you know, we're not going to convert each other on this, but we do agree on what matters most. And that is that in our country today, the most important, all kinds of very important decisions that determine our life chances, that determine your children's future, that determine our standard of living, our quality of life, that all these decisions about the condition and the future of the country, about what kind of country this country is going to be, these decisions are being made behind closed doors, in conversations between people, most of whose names we don't even know. And we are out in the cold. It's just, but Joe, my explanation for how this was done to us doesn't have anywhere near as many moving parts as yours. But it's that, you know, when people, you know, in the media and the commentariat, they look at Americans who believe in this or that political conspiracy, whether it's about President Kennedy or it's QAnon or however you, and they speak of these Americans in very disparaging and condescending terms. And my attitude is that, okay, I don't buy these conspiracy theories either, but on the other hand, at the heart of all of them is a very powerful grain of truth. And the grain of truth is that we, the people, are no longer masters in our own house, that our government does not represent us, that our freedom has been stolen from us. It's just that I think the explanation is a lot simpler. And the explanation above all is money and politics, as I see it. And that's good news for us, because that's actually a problem we can fix. So anyway, that's my speech about. But by the way, with regard to President Kennedy, just if you're curious, there's a wonderful book written by the investigative journalist Gerald Posner. It came out in 1993, around the 30th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. It's called Case Closed, Lee Harvey Oswald and the Assassination of JFK. And he goes through all the ballistics and the magic bullet theory, and he just debunks all of that. And he shows that the case for Oswald having been the lone assassin is just overwhelming. So if you're interested in that, it's a wonderful read, very reads like a crime novel, very entertaining. I found it completely persuasive. But anyway, but I've been running my mouth quite a long time now. I should let you get a word in edgewise now.
No, it's just interesting times, man, just watching what's happening. And it's at the same time that Trump almost got assassinated, it was that Joe Biden had COVID. So my conspiracy mind was wandering. I'm like, is the powers that be? Are they trying to eliminate both targets because they're both bad electors, you know? So,
oh, gosh. Well, I think the reality, Jay, in some ways, is even scarier than the notion that there are powers that be orchestrating it. I think the reality is that in Washington, no one is in charge because we've got interest group gridlock. And effectively, the country's drifting. You know, we're not, no one in the country, certainly not the people, but not even an elite, no one is making decisions about what kind of country we want to be. No one is setting a consistent policy, a rational course for our future. The country's just drifting, and we're drifting toward the edge of a cliff, as we've been doing for some time, because we've been kicking the can down the road on all these problems that we've got. I mean, we're running budget deficits of $2 trillion a year, and in Washington, the most that either party can do is occasionally pay lip service to the idea that we shouldn't be doing this. Our public schools are not nearly as good as they should be. Our infrastructure is crumbling. We've got environmental problems that are going unaddressed. Healthcare is costing twice as much as it should, and we're getting lousy results. And that's just sort of the highlights or the low points. And that said, I mean, we've got a lot of challenges that we've been neglecting. The good news is, look, we Americans are absolutely capable of meeting those challenges and fighting our way through to a bright future for ourselves. I mean, we've faced greater crises before. Frankly, compared to the twin crises of the Great Depression and the Second World War, I mean, here again, I'm speaking as an historian. It's always my default. I think what we're facing today is actually pretty manageable, pretty tame. The difference is, though, back then, we had a functioning democracy. Back then, all in all, the American people were in charge, and we chose good leaders, good presidents, and we had a good Congress that wasn't for sale, that worked with those presidents to master those challenges, and the country did great and heroic things. And I think if we can just put the American people back in the saddle where we belong, the country will go on to do great and heroic things again in future. But I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Do we want to talk about the chaos in the Democratic side of the aisle now?
Yeah, we can do. I just want to bring up something real quick. I just feel like the middle class is being pressed out over time through inflation and these skyrocketing prices, and the wages don't seem to be going up. So what I'm noticing is just like, how is the middle class going to survive? It feels like there's going to be this deep division where the middle class becomes low class, and then there's going to be this mega high class. So ultimately, what's going to happen is that these multimillionaires, these mega wealthy people, are just going to be able to pay to play the game and keep the laws rolling in that favor them. And it's going to be this two-tiered society. I just don't see a way how middle-class people are surviving. I mean, like childcare is so expensive, so people aren't going to be having kids anymore. Food is atrocious right now. I don't understand how people are even buying groceries. Rent on average for a studio, I'm paying $2,000. That's absurd. And when you talk to like, my grandparents' age, they're like, you're getting ripped off. Why are you paying for that? I'm like, if I go anywhere else, it's going to be the same. It's crazy. The housing market.
Where are you located, Jay, by the way?
Yeah, sure. So you said you taught in Illinois. I'm in Illinois, Arlington Heights.
Arlington Heights. I don't know where that is exactly.
30 minutes from downtown Chicago.
Well, that's, I was asking. That's, I guess, why it's so expensive. You're so close to a big city.
Right.
But the thing is, of course, if you were living in a cheaper part of the country, you'd probably be making less money as well. So, or could be. Yeah. I mean, no, you're right. I mean, I think that, I mean, the inflation is kind of just the latest kicker, or almost the straw that's breaking the camel's back. On the other hand, the hollowing out of the middle class has been going on for decades. And the other thing that's happened is that the path into the middle class, upward social mobility, has largely been cut off by several factors. One is a college education being priced out of reach for everyone. That's, you know, one of the most obvious data points. But yeah, I mean, it's been really quite a long time since our economy has worked for most Americans. It's worked very well for the 1% and especially the top 10th of 1%, but for the rest of us, it's not working. And one reason is that the top 10th of a percent, those are the people who can afford to write the kind of checks that politicians need to fund these, you know, crazy expensive campaigns they're running. So it's not the only factor, but it's one of them. But I agree with you. I mean, you say we're headed toward a two-tier society. I feel like to some degree we're already there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, the inflation, absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you a phrase that comes up all the time. I've talked to at this point more than 1,000 Americans, you know, of all political stripes, all walks of life, sort of directly, kind of one-on-one or in small groups since I started my campaign. And a phrase that comes up all the time is living paycheck to paycheck, scraping by.
Yeah.
And there was a survey that I saw a couple of months ago, and it was a list of all the things, like what percentage of Americans said they were giving up this item or that item in order to be able to pay their rent or mortgage. And it was more than a third of Americans said they had canceled or deferred a vacation. Almost 15% were saying that they were skipping meals. Think about that. 15% of American households skipping meals just to be able to pay their rent. 20% saying that they were not filling prescriptions that their doctors had given them. They need medicine, but they decided to skip the medicine in order to not get evicted.
Yeah.
So that's not what I would, that's not the American dream there.
No, that's a real problem. That's a real problem. Yeah. So it's disheartening when you see us sending money over to Ukraine, and there's so much infrastructure problem here on our own soil. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, my view is that we need to do both. I actually think that I probably shouldn't, this is a partisan statement, I probably shouldn't make it, but you know, I think that I will say this though, and I'm not saying this to defend, to side with President Biden. Because of one thing, I think the guy absolutely has to step aside, and he should have done it a long time ago as the nominee. But the money that we've sent to Ukraine has been a very profitable investment in our security, because the Ukrainians, God bless them, they've been so brave. They're heroes, and they have gutted Vladimir Putin's army through their valiant resistance. And they're doing the fighting and dying. And they are the contribution that they are making to our security and that of our NATO allies is tremendous. And the weapons, it's not that we're not mostly sending money over there for that government to spend or waste because there is corruption. We're mostly sending them weapons that are built in this country by American workers. So I actually think that economically and in all kinds of ways, providing weapons to Ukraine is a good deal for us, is a good deal for the American people. However, we also should be spending money here at home on infrastructure. And we should stop spending money on all kinds of, you know, pointless tax breaks and contracts for weapon systems that the military don't even want and certainly don't need. I mean, there's so much wasteful government spending because because lobbyists, you know, lobbyists control the spigot of campaign cash. Their clients spend money to help politicians, and lobbyists, it's amazing this is legal, they actually write checks out of their own fat salaries to the campaigns of senators and representatives who sit on the key committees they need to influence to benefit their clients. And as long as that's the case, the lobbyists can extract from Congress government contracts from the government that we really don't need, tax breaks for these corporations that are economically pointless, you know, all manner of wasteful spending and resources, money that could be put to good use, rebuilding our infrastructure. And if we put money into rebuilding our infrastructure in this country, we would in turn be creating all kinds of high-skilled, high-paying jobs for Americans. And that would help us rebuild our middle class. But we're not going to do that as long as the lobbyists are king.
How do you feel about what happened in Hawaii and the residents of Hawaii only getting a one-time payment of $700?
Is that what happened after the fire in Maui?
Yeah. Yeah. They got a one-time payment of $700. And a lot of people would say that seems like a land grab, what's happening over there.
I don't know the details, Jay, so I probably shouldn't comment on it. I definitely shouldn't comment on it. That sounds horrifying. But on the other hand, I can't say that it would surprise me. I'm not saying that I'm skeptical about that having been the case, but since I don't know the facts, I'm gonna refrain from commenting.
I understand. Yeah. But from my point of view, what I've read, it's just that's crazy. That's crazy. It's like you're supposed to take care of your Americans first, and you see something like that, and just kind of. But we'll move on since you don't know about it. I urge you to try and read that story about it after this podcast, though. How do you feel about the first lady behind Joe Biden? Because clearly we see that Joe's not doing okay. Like there's signs of dementia. There's some real signs of Parkinson's we've seen. Just he's not mentally all there. And then, you know, after that first debate between Trump and Biden, Biden needed help walking off the stage. He just looks stiff all the time. He doesn't look right. And then I guess he was having some kind of press conference and his wife was like, "You answered all the questions. You're doing such a good job."
No, that was after the debate. She went up on the stage with him. And she said, you know, you was such a great performance. You answered all the questions, and then she helped him off the stage.
Okay. Yeah.
As to dementia or Parkinson's, I'm not a doctor. I have no opinion, but I will say, to me, it's been clear no later than the beginning of this year that the poor man is exhausted.
Yeah.
Sure. And every time you see him at the podium, he just seems so feeble. And yeah. And then also the fact that, you know, he's held the fewest unscripted press conferences by a president in more than 40 years. I guess the last one to be anywhere near who had this little unscripted, you know, contact with the press was Ronald Reagan. And access to both Vice President Harris and President Biden by the media has been very tightly controlled and very limited. And there's, in Biden's case, at least, there's no mystery why. And he shouldn't have run for a second term. And in fact, you know, going back, you know, back in 2022, when I think that decision was made, you know, when by whatever means, the Democratic Party establishment and all the people who should have challenged Biden for the nomination kind of all agreed on a Biden coronation and just allowed this joke of a primary process, you know, an uncontested primary. Back then and in ever since in the polls, you had two-thirds of Democratic voters saying we do not want him to run for a second term. And to me, that's just further proof of something I've always believed very strongly, is that the American people weren't born yesterday. We're no fools. The voters have eyes. They could see that Biden didn't have it in him, didn't have the mojo for another term. They wanted a fresh face. But the Democratic Party, that is, it's the party establishment, and I think its media allies kind of all decided to ignore their voters and arrange a Biden-Harris coronation. And now they're reaping what they have sown. And, you know, what's remarkable to me, you look at all the public conversation after his debate performance or non-performance, which is now about 3.5 weeks ago, it was astonishing to me hear all these Democrats acting surprised as if they didn't know this him. And yet, to me, it was obvious. In particular, you know, if you remember in February, Special Counsel Herr issued his report and effectively said he basically was saying, I don't think I can convict this guy because the jury's going to sympathize with him.
Yes.
Seeing him as a well-meaning elderly man with memory issues or with memory problems, right? And, you know, Biden then was so upset, he went to the podium in the briefing room the same day to defend himself. And he looked terrible. And he also confused the president of Mexico with the president of Egypt. And at that point, to me, it was obvious. It was like, he's got to go. And I wrote an op-ed that I submitted to three print publications. Wasn't published. And then I stopped submitting it, actually. But basically what I argued back then is what I'm arguing today, and which a lot of Democrats now publicly are arguing today, is that Biden needs to step aside and that the party can't just hand off the nomination to Harris. They can't have a Harris coronation, that they really got to give Democratic voters a kind of say. They need an open process. And what they should do is, you know, let the delegates at the convention vote their conscience. And between now and then, they can allow a sort of an open audition for the nomination among the, say, 4 or 6 or 8 Democrats who are kind of the usual suspects, the obvious choices, of course, Vice President Harris, but, you know, governors Whitmer and Beshear, Newsom, maybe a few others, and let those candidates take their case directly to the American people in media interviews instead of hiding from the media the way that Biden and Harris have done. Let them take every interview they can get. Let them give speeches. Let the party stage a few televised debates. And everyone will be taking polls. And come convention time, there's still time for the public to get a look at some of these candidates and for the polls to reveal who seems to arouse the most enthusiasm among the voters. And then, you know, let the delegates at the convention pick the nominee. And although, strictly speaking, Democratic voters would not determine the choice because they didn't elect the delegates, nonetheless, by expressing their preference in opinion polls, the voters, Democratic voters, for the first time this cycle, would actually have some influence on who the party's standard bearer is going to be. And I think that would, you know, it's funny, the party still seems to see this crisis with Biden only as a disaster and a crisis. To me, it's a priceless opportunity. You know, I've never heard of a situation like this where a party had a losing ticket that they knew was a losing ticket and actually had the chance to replace that ticket with a better one. And they do. And if they were to follow this process, and if Biden does the right thing and steps aside soon, which he really should have done yesterday or 2 weeks ago, but if he does, then if they open the process this way, there's going to be excitement. They're going to get media attention. They're going to get voter attention. People are not going to be talking about Trump all summer. They're going to be talking about who's going to be the Democratic nominee. There's going to be, you know, suspense and excitement and drama. And the voters are going to feel engaged. The voters are going to feel like they've got skin in the game. And the Democrats could turn this around. I think they could even win if they play it right. I mean, right now they're on track to get slaughtered. So, and I just feel a need to observe that I was saying this already in February, which I think confirms the soundness of my political instincts, because only now everyone else is catching up. That's obnoxious of me, I know, but
I mean, quite frankly, it seemed like all they needed was a person on stage that speaks English. And there could have been a real chance for the Democrats, and they couldn't even do that. Like he wasn't doing a good job speaking at all, Joe Biden.
No.
And so it seems like they did drop the ball right now. But I'm curious to your thoughts. Why would they roll this plan out as to keeping Biden and Harris? I just don't understand the plan. Is it because people are afraid of losing their jobs. Like this, like there's a machine that's running in the background and they feel very comfortable because they have the control.
Oh, so you're saying like why did they arrange to have Biden and Harris, the nominees, the candidate ticket in the first place, you're saying?
Right. Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Why was there not a contested nomination like there should have been in 2022? Well, I think that, you know, I think you put your finger clearly on one factor. There's just no question that there's Biden's got, you know, a huge team. He's got a group of loyalists. He's got his own people in the White House. He's got the people who ran his 2020 campaign who are running the campaign now. And for those people, obviously, they have a powerful incentive for him to stay the candidate because they can then they have jobs this cycle running the election campaign. And if he wins, then they get to be in the White House for another 4 years. So that's understandable. I don't doubt that that's a factor. I don't know that those people are really that they have such all consuming power. I think for me, I guess the factor I focus on that's so dramatic to me and really kind of makes me angry is just that the degree to which the party, you know, that all the, you know, all the leading elected Democrats, all these governors and cabinet secretaries who should have challenged Biden for the nomination but didn't, and the people at the Democratic National Committee, that they seem to think that that the voters' opinion didn't matter at all. And the fact that they thought it was okay to just ignore the two-thirds of Democratic voters who are saying, we don't want him to run again. And you have to say that the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party claims to stand for democracy. And I don't doubt their sincerity. I think that is what they want to do and what they believe they stand for. But it's really quite ironic and deplorable that they have conducted their nomination in a process that is not just undemocratic, small d undemocratic, but anti-democratic. I mean, they arranged a Biden coronation against the expressed wishes of two-thirds of their own voters. And that is really reprehensible. And you know, it's also very harmful to them. You know, their chief message, you know, in this campaign has been that, you know, Donald Trump and his MAGA Republicans are an existential threat to American democracy. You need us to save democracy from President Trump. And yet the Republicans conducted their nominating process in a small d democratic fashion. You had a bunch of establishment candidates like Haley and DeSantis and Tim Scott, who had robust financial backing from the Republican donor class, from sort of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wing of the Republican Party. But Republican voters who made clear in 2016 that they were sick of the Republican establishment, and they showed that by electing President Trump in 2016, nominating him, those same voters were not buying it. They did not want to see another establishment candidate this cycle. A lot of them, it was clear, would have preferred someone other than President Trump, but they also didn't want another establishment candidate. So having nothing but establishment candidates and President Trump, they chose President Trump. And so on the Republican side, the nominee is someone that Republican voters actually wanted, who won a contested nomination fair and square.
Yeah.
On the Democratic side, the party ignored its own voters and rammed the Biden-Harris ticket down the throats of Democratic voters. And as a consequence, even before the debate, long before the debate, you know, by the beginning of this year, there's this massive enthusiasm gap with a large fraction, I think north of 30% of Republican voters enthusiastic about President Trump, not just lesser two evils, enthusiastic. I really want him. I like him.
With and on the picture side, that he has out now of him with the blood on his ear and him raising his fist, that's probably the hardest picture I've ever seen. That's gonna be so hard to beat, man.
It is a very powerful image. It is a very powerful image, and there's no question that is. It's added some additional oomph to the race. But the thing is that. The thing is that the Republicans have really had the momentum and the enthusiasm and the excitement all the way through this cycle, because they actually listened to their own voters. And the Democrats did the opposite, and they're paying the price. But the thing is, you know, they should thank their lucky stars that Biden's team insisted on the first debate being this early, which was very, which was unprecedented. Because now Biden's frailty has and cognitive decline has been revealed for all to see.
Yes.
You can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And even this Democratic establishment that doesn't seem to care about what its own voters think, they're finally having their come to Jesus moment. They're recognizing we can't win with this guy. We're going to get slaughtered.
That and almost I do seems think like that, a ploy a little bit to put him out on stage, because they had to – they know how he is. They know it. They see it. They spend most of the time with him. They have to understand that he's not all there. So they're maybe they're like, all right, you go on stage. He's going to do what he does, and he's going to have to drop out. Like, let's just put him out there, and then he's going to have to drop out.
That's fascinating, Jay. You know, Jay, I have no insight into that, and I can't offer an opinion – because I don't have any connections within the Democratic Party or to the inner circle. I've never met these people, but I think your theory, I think it has plausibility. I really don't know. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if at least one or two people on Biden's team who pressed for the early, you know, the early debate thought, well, you know, yeah, let's set him up to fail. Let's get it out there so that no one can be in denial about this any longer.
Could be.
So that we have a chance.
Maybe not.
I'm definitely not going to say that I agree with that, but I don't think it's implausible. I don't think it's implausible at all. I mean, these people are not stupid. And the people around him, they have to know, and they've had to know for a very long time. And of course, there's been such excellent reporting in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times. I read kind of every print outlet there is, and I got about 40 or 50 news sources because I like to get all the perspectives. But here, you know, this is reporting from the New York Times, which is a clearly a pro-Democratic Party outlet, and they're talking about really that within Biden's inner circle and behind closed doors that all kinds of people have noticed, especially in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months, whatever, a sharp decline in Biden. And that they've been hiding it. And of course, you know, you remember George Clooney. I mean, I say God bless him for writing his op-ed in the Times and saying I was, you know, he said I was at a fundraiser for I staged a fundraiser for President Biden 3 weeks ago. The man I saw at the fundraiser was the same man we saw on the debate stage, a guy who was failing, who was frail and confused and exhausted. But it's the question is also all the people who are at that fundraiser who saw this, it's let it be to their everlasting shame that they didn't speak up earlier. That said, I do give Clooney at least some credit for being one of the ones who, you know, had the mojo or the integrity to step up and say that.
Yeah, I agree.
And in any case, you know, it's interesting, though, you know, on Friday, I mean, which was just yesterday, there was the news coverage I was seeing, particularly in Axios, the consensus seemed to be that Biden was going to step aside possibly as soon as tomorrow.
Saw that
this
as
morning
well.
Now, there are renewed reports that he is digging in his heels.
Indeed.
And you know, you raised at the beginning, you raised, you know, Dr. Biden, the first lady. It's just these are reports. I only know what I read in the papers, right? But there are a lot of reports to the effect that that Biden's inner circle is narrowed, Biden apparently for quite some time now has a habit of not wanting to hear bad news and of flying into a rage if you give him bad news. And more his inner circle has been filtering information that goes to him so that in effect he more and more has been surrounded by yes men and yes women. And now it seems they've been saying recently in recent weeks that that Jill Biden and Hunter Biden have been the gatekeepers, and they're not letting people through to him who will give him the bad news, the bad political news. Despite that, I mean, I think he's had a sit down with Nancy Pelosi and with Chuck Schumer, and they told him, you know, you can't win. You got to step aside. But I have to say it is not to the credit of our First Lady, if that's what she's doing. And she seems to be doing that. And it seems very selfish. But then again, it seems to be selfish, but I think it's also kind of universally human. You know, when you find yourself in a position like that, that is so privileged, and when you have power, then power and influence, it's very hard to let it go. And it's very easy for you to lose perspective and talk yourself into thinking that you're indispensable. And Joe Biden is not the first president to do that. So, but it's, all I can say is I'm just praying for the sake, not because I want Democrats to win. I don't care about either party winning. I think both parties are useless at this point. But for the sake of the country, I think that the American people deserve a real choice in November. And right now, if Biden stays on the ticket, the American people don't have a real choice. You know, I think that would really be terrible. And I think that they have a priceless opportunity to actually empower their own voters finally in the process, generate some genuine enthusiasm, it would be a brief sort of mini primary, as Jim Clyburn calls it, but it would be a campaign of ideas. That's the other thing about it. You know, the primary process, it really wasn't until 1972 that primaries were the way that we chose our nominees. Up to that point, it was conventions. That was the norm. And the parties, both parties decided, it was the Democrats first, that using the primary system would be more democratic. It would give the voters a say. And that may have been a good idea at the time, but because elections have become so expensive, in effect, the primary process is now one that more disenfranchises voters, because the cost of running a primary campaign is so high, it is prohibitive. It creates a barrier for entry to all kinds of otherwise promising candidates. The way that candidates communicate with the voters is not sort of in honest conversations, in media interviews or town halls. The chief way that they influence the voters and quote unquote communicate with the voters is these massive, hyper expensive ad buys of 30-second campaign ads that increasingly consist only of sleazy attacks on their opponents. And that's not a democratic process either. That's not government by the people. And the irony is that if they just let the delegates at the convention do it, then the candidates, you know, whoever's in the running, they're not going to have time to raise money and start, you know, pumping out 30-second ads. They're just going to have a campaign of ideas. And the nomination will go to the candidate who is kind of the most open and honest and who's being square with the people and has the best ideas and expresses themselves in a straightforward fashion. And you would ironically end up with, in small d democratic terms, the most democratic nominating process we've had in 40 years. And I guess that's another reason why I would just love it if they would do that. And I still think the odds are in favor of their doing it, but the news we just read this morning about that Biden's digging in his heels and doesn't want to let go is enough to make you tear your hair out if you really care for the future of our country.
Yep, I agree. Well said. I agree. Got one more question for you, and this is opinion-based. I'm just curious, if Trump was assassinated, like if it was successful, we completely enter a new paradigm. Like, what does that look like? Do you think that would cause outrage for a civil war? Like, that's how divided our country is.
I don't think that. I mean, I think that it would have been terrible. And, you know, I can't tell you how grateful I am that the guy missed and crazy that he's unhurt. I mean, you know, and that would have been a terrible, terrible thing for our country for that to happen. I do not doubt that for all kinds of ways. That said, Civil War, I don't think we're there yet. I think if we continue on the path we're on for another 15, 20, or even 30 years, then you can, you know, really massive civil violence, I think, is conceivable. I don't think we're there yet. I don't really accept that the people are also bitterly divided. I think if you look at social media, you get the impression that half the country hates the other half. But you got to remember, on social media, it's the angry people who post the most.
You're right.
You get a very distorted picture of public opinion. And there's a lot of polling data that shows that the great bulk of the American people are saying again and again, I don't want this anger. You know, I don't like this negative advertising. I also hear this constantly in conversations with Americans on both sides of the aisle when I'm talking about my work, that another thing that I hear very, very often is I get these TV ads. All they do is tear down the other guy, and they never tell me what they're going to do for me.
I say that all the time.
And you're right to say it, and it's true. And I think that, you know, what's really ironic is that, I mean, yeah, they have succeeded in polarizing us a lot, but still, on the other hand, I think that below the toxic level of politics, I think in our communities, in the workplace, in our schools, I think we actually get along better than we have ever. I mean, I think I do understand that there are people who've lost friendships over political disagreements. I understand that there are rifts in families because of that. But for example, in other respects, like other prejudices that people have, you know, by race or gender or sexual orientation, I think that you look at polling data, you look at just observing how what life is like here in New York City compared to 30 years ago. I think that below the level of politics, which plays upon our prejudices, I think that if left to our own devices, I think we the people would get along fine, I guess is the best way to put it. And I think the problem is at the level of politics. I agree that our parties and their elected officials of the parties and their media allies, they are badly polarized. They are polarizing us for their own purposes. They're doing a lot of damage to the country. But I still feel there's plenty of time to turn this around.
Yeah, right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up, Dr. Dan. I appreciate you, man. You have a realist and optimistic way of looking at things, which is kind of refreshing.
Good.
You're well-spoken. You critically think. You can hear that. Just thank you for not having a bias as well. You're kind of open to all ideas. You didn't go all in on one party, which we seem to see a lot of, and I'm trying to follow your tracks as well. So thank you for speaking.
Can I just say a little bit more about my optimism and why I have it?
For sure.
Because I think it's something that we've forgotten, and particularly the people in politics have forgotten about this country. And this is something that comes from my first career as a professional historian, and especially from the fact that my field was not American history, but rather German history. And when you can see our country, when you can lay the history of our country alongside that of every other country, it's when you come to appreciate the greatness of the American people and the United States of America, you come to appreciate something about the things that make our country unique, things that all Americans understood at one point, but which the people who supposedly lead this country have forgotten, namely that this is the only country on earth that stands for something, that stands for ideals. And, you know, for me, the Holy Trinity of American ideals is individual freedom, equality of opportunity, government by the people, which we invented in its modern form, and more than 800,000 Americans down to the generations gave their lives in wars fought for the freedom of others to make government by the people and these other ideals a possibility, a reality for all of humankind. You know, I mean, every other country on earth, membership in the nation depends on race, ethnicity, language, culture, religion, usually a combination of the above. This is the only country where membership in the nation depends on ideals. I mean, ideals make us Americans. Fighting for these ideals, both at home and abroad, is what Americans do. And, you know, there's just the potential of this country, that this country has, is just, is awe-inspiring. And the only thing that is holding us back is this hopelessly broken political system. And the people who should be leading us but aren't have forgotten that our country stands for these ideals, probably because they understand better than anyone that we no longer have government by the people here in the land of its birth. But I tell you, from my conversations with Americans on both sides of the aisle, in almost 100 media interviews I've given on outlets across the spectrum politically, the American people have not forgotten these ideals. The American people are still deeply committed to these ideals. And, you know, you observe that I don't go in from one party or another. And it's because when I look at everyone, even when I look at people who say things that are really extreme in politics that are hateful, that I don't like, at the end of the day, to me, they're all Americans. And I love them all. I love them a lot. And I think that we have, if we can just fix the dysfunction of our political system and get ourselves back in charge, we're going to have no trouble coming together as one people, working together, and striving again toward the fulfillment of the noble ideals that make us Americans. And I have to tell you, people see only, all the political messaging is gloom and doom. I say to you, I think that we're going to turn this around. I think the place we're going to start is fixing the money problem. I think the voter dollars, you know, reform that I champion is the best first step. And I think sooner or later we're going to do that, because as soon as enough Americans understand how this was done to us, how we lost our freedom, our say in how we are governed, and as soon as enough Americans understand that they're actually, that we're not helpless, that we can fix this, because, you know, for every other people on earth, the democratic form of government is an option. It's not optional for us. It's who we are. It defines us. And that is a source of strength, of a sense of national purpose that no other people has access to, but we do. And that's why, you know, you ask me, is America the greatest country on earth? Are the American people the greatest people who have ever walked this earth? I'll say, you bet we are. I'll scream it from every rooftop. And this is
damn right.
All right. And I can say that to Americans in every part of the country, of all races and classes, you know, all religions, all political stripes. At the end of the day, to me, every American is a patriot, because every American believes in the beautiful ideals that make us a nation. And we all want our country to live up to these ideals and go on to greater and greater heroic things. And we will. We absolutely will.
Magnificent. Home of the brave, land of the free, America.
That is exactly right. At the moment, we're still very much the home of the brave, land of the free, not so much, but we will get our freedom back. Absolutely.
We'll get it back. I appreciate you, Dr. Dan. We will have to have you on for another podcast, because there's so much more to discuss with you. You know, there's just, you're a wealth of knowledge.
I really enjoyed our conversation, Jay, and I'm always at your service.
I appreciate it. Hey, one more thing. Let everyone know where they can find you, where they can buy your book again.
Oh, yeah, please. So, I'm going to give my website URL twice because it's long. It's savedemocracyinamerica.org. Savedemocracyinamerica.org. Although if you just Google my name, Dan McMillan, and money in politics or democracy, you'll find me soon enough. And at the website, there are FAQs, some explanatory videos, links to some of my media interviews, information about my personal background, an image of the book of my book on the causes of the Holocaust. We used to have a donation button, but I removed it because I decided I can afford to fund our efforts out of my own pocket, and that's what I'm doing.
That's nice.
And I want something from everyone in the audience that is so much more valuable than any money that you might want to give or could give, and that is validation. Because ultimately, this voter dollars idea is just, it's a great idea. It's common sense, you know, and it's about the ideals that make us Americans. It has bipartisan appeal. I've seen this time and again. And the real obstacle we face is just that so many Americans are discouraged, and we've been lied to so many times. We've been promised change so many times and not given it. We're disillusioned, which no one can fault us for that. And how do you overcome the pessimism? By hearing from people who have hope. And I say to you, please, if what I say makes sense to you, tell others about this conversation, encourage them to listen to Jay's podcast, go to my website, share my website with friends by email or on social media. Because, you know, I go on radio and TV and podcasts, I speak in person, I make my best case, but most of the people in the audience don't know me from Adam. But someone who knows you, trusts you, respects you, with them, my message is 100 times more powerful coming from you than will ever be coming from me. And that's ultimately, that's what I need from you. That's what I ask from you, is validation, is your seal of approval on our effort for voter dollars. And that's how we win, one American at a time. We just get this word out. And once enough Americans are talking about it and Americans say, wow, this could really happen. We're not defeated. You know, we can take our country back. Then I think this thing will snowball and it will happen a lot faster than people think. And so don't think you can't move the ball down the field. You absolutely can.
Awesome. All right. I'll have the links in the description of this podcast as well. Dr. Dan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you again.
Likewise. Thank you, Jay. Hey. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Everyone at home, thanks for listening. Go check out the links in the description. Stay American.